Welcome everybody back to the Reflex Blues Show. We are recording from the Heinz Convention Center here in Boston, Massachusetts at the HAL Live, what is it, 5-day event, whatever it
Gala,
is.
Gala, spectacular, woo! I don't know what they call
crazy.
It.
And we are here with speakers Luke Micey and Diana Valentine. I am Donovan Beery, and I'm my co-host Ben Luders.
Hello everybody.
So excited to be.
So we're talking roller derby. You went to the first game, you said?
Is it a game? Yeah, my first
are they
ever
game?
Match? Maybe a match?
I've never been, so I've just heard the Jim Croce song, which I really like, Roller Derby Queen. So.
Yeah. Let's call it a roller derby grind. It was awesome. I totally had goosebumps the whole time, and I got a water bottle and some socks that say badass.
So we've heard.
When do you think you'll start taking up roller derby?
Well, there's a clinic coming up in July, but I'm not committing to it.
Have you skated before?
Roller skated since I was maybe middle school.
Okay.
I think I could pick it right back up.
I've never been to a match. I think Omaha might have it now. I haven't been.
No, I heard that. Yeah, one just came into Omaha. Yeah.
Okay. So it's all women dressing, and it's like half roller skating and half boxing, or
there's a lot of pushing.
Chariot racing, sort of, you know,
yeah. Elbowing, pushing.
It's strategic pushing. It's blocking.
Right.
I've seen a little bit on TV. It's fascinating.
Wasn't there a TV show for a while where it was like,
oh really?
It wasn't American Gladiator, but there was some. It was kind of that. It was around the same time where American Gladiator was big, where there was a roller derby show.
I know you're a little older than I am.
Yeah, this
so
sounds before
my
time.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Maybe it was a VHS we're talking.
I don't think so, Diane.
Was it in color, Luke?
Yeah.
Was this show in color?
Yeah, oh. I'm not even going to answer that question. Sorry, next question.
Was where men played all the roles?
No, it was girls.
It's like the Shakespeare roller derby.
I understand.
Didn't think it was very funny,
just,
did you?
No, I'm just passing that gotcha. Question. I'm just
ooh, fight, fight. I like this. I like the tension in the room.
There's if only we
tension.
Had some skates, we could duke this out in a roller derby method. We've got some tape.
Yeah, I wouldn't get into a ring with Diana on a roller
smart.
Derby.
Very
smart.
Wise. When man. We first walked in this room to check out the where we, you know, the people at Howard Gray, they've set us up with a great recording room again. We're far enough away where we don't hear the conference. But this room's got to be, what is this, 20, 20
million 40
square
by
foot.
Yeah,
40 by 40, and the ceiling's got to be 30 foot tall,
yeah,
maybe.
Easy.
Oh, easy.
So it's this giant cube, and we walked in here, and we're like, well, these shows are going to echo.
Sounds great, right?
Yeah, for some reason, you know, they got tablecloths here, we got carpet, and the walls are carpeted up for the first, yeah. like, 8 foot.
So it's the best sound booth you've ever been in.
It's yeah, not it's bad.
Classy.
Yeah. Actually, the best one we were ever in was We went and interviewed Hoops and Yo-Yo a couple years ago over at Hallmark.
Mm.
And they just put us in their conference room, so it's echoey and stuff, and it's just okay. And it's not even this good. But then when they're done, they're like, hey, that was fun. They're like, hey, you want to be on the Hoops and Yo-Yo podcast? And me and Nate were like, sure. So we go in there. They got a professional sound booth, like, next door, and it's just for them because they do all those flash
videos. But they didn't
videos.
Let you use it?
I don't even think they thought about it. And afterwards, I'm just thinking, I'm like, why aren't we in here? Like,
mince meat.
Yeah, it was.
Wow,
it was weird.
They're just trying to get you in and out.
You said Hallmark had like three of those on their campus, and they just had one to themselves over in the shoebox area. So I'm like, it's not even being used. Great, and you put us in the conference room.
Right.
You guys even? Yeah, those guys are great though. They're a lot of fun. Much like yourselves. So we're going to talk.
Speaking of you guys,
let's start with Diana. Diana, what are you speaking about? Here at the HAL this year?
I'm rocking in-house and talking about Super Conditions for Greatness, and then I'm emceeing a couple of happy hours and doing a Pitch Perfect workshop and also a collaboration workshop with Jim Krause on 30 Ways to Stay Creative.
And we're going to talk about that here in a few weeks. Mm-hmm. Well, it'll be later. It'll be like in 2 days. But
radio weeks.
Radio weeks.
Radio weeks. So podcast weeks.
Well, just this room is big enough to set up some tents and just stay in here for months.
Yeah.
It's just podcast
squat. What are the squatting laws in Boston? It seems like you could probably get away with something.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You know? It's a revolutionary town.
Well, what has changed on the Pitch Perfect talk since we've last spoke to you about it?
Oh, dude. This year, what I decided to do at CFC is do a live sort of performance education piece. So I'm getting five people who've already volunteered to come up on stage with me and work on the different segments of Pitch Perfect. So it's the same kind of general structure, but lots and lots of live action, way more workshopping. Because the feedback I got was, we love the idea of it, but we didn't get enough examples. So it was hard for us to do it on our own. So here we go. Live action it is.
And how, are you going to change anything on the feedback? Like, have you given this yet, or is this given, like, tomorrow, the Pitch Perfect?
Well, I'm giving it later today at 2:15, yeah.
Okay, so you'll have to chime in. We'll ask you on your next show how it actually went.
Yeah, it's an experiment, but I'm prepared for it to go swimmingly well.
And Diana, you mentioned these super conditions for greatness,
oh,
is that right?
Yeah.
And we heard a little bit of that over breakfast yesterday. Gosh, it seems like a week ago. So much happened
when you
yesterday.
Were paying attention.
Yeah, well, we were in the middle of like blogging and podcasting from the back of the room, and then Diana calls on Donovan, and he was like in the zone.
And jumped right in. That improvisational part of you was brilliant.
Ben told me how to answer. He's just like, Donovan,
I just
say this. Just,
no matter what she's saying, just say Jedi. And he did, and everyone laughed.
And
it's
it
like,
was
Jedi, that's funny. Star Wars is great.
It was the question was something about like if you could have any business title you want. But Ben knew that was the one I'd probably take.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Outside of the one that we had now, isn't that correct?
Yeah, and it was brilliant. You basically made my workshop for me.
There you go. People started listening and getting involved right after the Jedi thing went down.
No one was paying attention to me until then.
Yeah. Well, I think part of it is they're like, oh, she's going to start calling us out.
Yeah.
We got it.
Turtle.
Key to the speaker, when you know that they're going to start calling on people, people get alert.
Just, yeah.
But on that talk, Diana, I wanted to know if you could just briefly explain what the super conditions
totally.
Idea is, and then also, what has your feedback been from people at this conference?
I got more feedback from that one session than I did from probably all five sessions last year. It was incredible. Oh, wow. It really struck a nerve. Because I think the magic of super conditions is that once you're aligned with your purpose, your philosophy, your internal workings, and you put them in your own words, and then you design everything around you to suit that and to magnify those in a positive way, everything gets easier. And it also gets really exciting. I mean, it appeals to our navel gazer in a way, but it makes us more functional with other people. So mm-hmm. Seems to be working really well. And I heard that a couple of people were working on it at happy hours last night and talking about mm-hmm. super conditions this morning, and I had a full round table, so people are pretty turned on by it.
Well, they know you're going to call them out later in the conference,
yeah.
So they have to...
preparing for the mic.
Right.
They're actually just scared. They're doing it out of fear.
They're doing it because they're afraid that I'll punish them if they don't show up.
Way to scare everybody. You are
one of the super conditions.
I am so intimidating.
I mean, the super condition for a Sith would be fear, right? Would that be
yeah, there you go.
Well, but they're not afraid. That. So right, super conditions are internal to the Sith. So I would say intimidation might be a super condition for the Sith.
We talked to Operation Nice yesterday. I think you need to start some Operation Scary or something like that.
What are your super conditions, Diana?
I'll tell you. I have a super condition for the tall order. I like the challenge. I like things that require a high level of excellence, especially when it's new competencies. So I work with a lot of different industries. Love it. Because I don't really need to know what you're doing, but I'll learn as I go. So that's super fun.
And we're going to call out Luke, what are your super conditions? You know this is coming. We've got to keep you alert.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, wake up, dude. What's wrong with you?
I was falling asleep.
Just say Jedi.
Jedi.
That's right. When in doubt.
Jedi. Super conditions. I think that there's two that come to mind, and that is I love helping people. There's something that is fulfilled with me when I'm in a position where I can help people, which allows me sometimes to divert relationships if I don't feel like I can help them. So I don't waste time with, especially on the client side, with clients that I don't feel I can help. The other is I think that I give people courage. I think people sometimes don't have the courage to stand up and say, but I said this in my talk yesterday, I have enough guts to go around so they can borrow some of mine.
That's a great name of a super condition, enough guts to go around.
And I really do. Like the reason I call people out is because I'm willing to kind of say, you know, I put my head on the line, you should too. And so I would say those two. I think I inject courage in people, and I also I love helping people. So it's why I speak. I mean, it's why I work with clients. It's why I do everything.
No, I love it. Well, we're gonna be right back, and then we're gonna go into what Luke's doing here in Boston. Yeah, we just told Luke and Diana that we're recording here. The next section here will be about Luke's talk, and then
lock
answering
the doors.
Questions from Ricardo, and Ricardo has actually texted Luke here in between the shows.
And what did he say, Luke?
He said, "I just effed you over with the questions you have to answer. Much love, brother."
All right. Well,
he knows better
he's right
than
on.
To text me.
Diana just wouldn't have shown up. Her super condition is knowing when to just bail.
Fuck you.
All right. So on to Luke.
Luke, what are you talking about this year at the How? And how many Hows have you spoken at now?
This is my third.
Okay, and have they been three in a row?
Yes.
Now, we've had you on the show because last year you spoke at the Creative Freelancer, and we were recording at that time. We're missing the entire day today because of these interviews, which is great. I mean, we love it. But I heard great, great things about what you spoke, and
Thank you.
Of the freelancers thought they were real motivated after they left. So we said, well, we got to get Luke on to hear
very good
what he can do. So which conference are you speaking at this year?
I spoke at CFC. I opened the first session on... Would have been Thursday morning. Which day is it? Yeah. Today is what?
It was
just
yesterday.
Friday.
Yeah, but today's Friday. The days all mash together when I come to Hal, so there's too much late night.
Release yourself to the 24-hour cycle.
Yeah, there's a 24-hour cycle for sure. There's very little sleep, actually, in that 24-hour
cycle. For you.
Well, yeah, some of us aren't as responsible as you, Diana.
You get a good night's sleep, Diana.
Or like incapable as me. Like, I just can't hang. I trained for this.
I know you trained and you still bailed early. You still bailed early.
Did you just bail right after the game?
I think it was a fourth inning.
You didn't even go through the game.
I couldn't. I was like, at first, my clothes were liquid. That was one
Boston's
thing.
Boston's nice this
time of
year.
The Red Sox
freaking
game,
hot.
It had to be over 100 degrees.
Oh, easy. Easy. And you're crammed into a little tiny stadium.
And everybody's touching.
Oh, yeah. When I was walking around in the stands and stuff, it was just sweltering in there. Like, actually sitting out in the stadium was all right, but when I was out in there with, like...
Getting snacks and cotton candy.
Well, maybe. it was hot.
But no beer.
Very hot.
No beer.
No beer. This was a beer-free zone.
Yeah. I don't know if they have that here in Boston. So.
Yeah. Not at baseball games.
No.
And I love the old stadiums because there's an energy to it. And people are that
just
close to
special.
The field. The one drawback, though, is that when you're in the new stadiums, you're like, oh, I have, like, arm room.
Right.
Yeah.
And those old ones, they just...
Steve Gordon and I were talking about... You think about this.
Steve's a tall guy.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah. But he just kind of has an aura about him.
We all like to touch him.
Yeah.
But didn't you also feel like I feel like the fans are fiercer. Like there was a dude in front of me. I was sort of mingling among the rows. But there was a dude sitting in front of me that kept turning around going, watch a game!
That's the MO of Red Sox fans. I mean, that's Red Sox fans, Yankees fans. Like they're hardcore.
Like why are you here if not to watch the game?
Right.
Yeah, right at the end.
I was literally turned around backwards and he's like, watch the game!
Yeah.
Right at the end when they were doing the home runs, there was this guy that every time they made a home run, he would like turn around and give everybody high fives. Not a part of our group, just got to give everybody high five.
Yeah.
So love it.
So what are you looking forward to? Now you've already spoken then.
I didn't. I spoke opening. Yeah.
And do you speak again or are you?
No, I'm done. This is actually
you're
the last
chilling.
Thing that I have to do.
So since with that going on, what is it you're looking most forward to? What is it that inspires you outside of?
You know, the thing I love about conferences is the in-between time and the relationships that I've built, even in the 3 years. I enjoy some of the sessions, but I don't feel like I am sessions burn me out. People charge me up. And so being out and interacting with people is kind of what gets me excited personally. I also feel like I know all the stuff I need to do already. So I need more practice in doing and less practice in just sitting and listening. And so it's just really fun for me to be in between. I love even the conversations with people that heard me talk and the questions that they're challenging me and really helping them, you know, figure out things. I had some great conversations this morning at the breakfast roundtable with a couple different people about their parts of their business they're trying to figure out and parts of their model, which was great. So and some of it was spurred from just the conversations I had after my talk. So.
And Luke, for our listeners, I was kind of a little confused at first because I know, Diana, you're not a designer, but you work with creatives and you help them, you know, think through. Luke, you are a designer.
Right.
That's correct. Cross Grain, is that?
Yeah, so I did about 10 years. I've been in business for 16 years. I would say that the first 10 years were very much design.
Mm-hmm.
I do a lot more marketing strategy now than I do design, even though design is involved. And it really just came out of me asking clients why we were doing things. It was in some ways, kind of a selfish question because what I found for me is if a client asks me to do something and the reason we're doing it doesn't make sense, I can't find my creativity, no matter how hard I look. And my process is such that what they're asking me to do has to make sense. I have to be excited about it. And I think it comes from that recently discovered desire to help people. Like, I have to feel like I'm helping people. And just executing what they're asking me doesn't feel like I'm helping, because I see things in business that a lot of people don't see, where I know that there's something different we should be doing. And my whole business model shift when I really started stepping up and saying, okay, my role is not to just react to them, but it's actually to look at their business and say, no, you really need to be doing this. And then out of that, I'm really creative, because I get excited about what I'm doing.
And it seems like you went to react to revolution, because you've really turned businesses around in really radical ways that aren't necessarily just based on visual design, for sure.
Very little of it's based on visual design. Actually, the design part is very easy for me once I figure that out. But I'm getting involved in company culture now. I'm getting involved in all sorts of different things. But it all comes from that central place of why I work, which is to help people.
Right. How do you go about finding clients that want you to do this for them?
You have to be very, very, very selective. So it's a different type of process than a lot of designers. You know, it's that kind of hunting method where you're out hunting for projects, and maybe you land a client that delivers projects all the time, but it's still very much a hunting. You're still selling yourself continually to that client, whereas mine is very much a relationship-based. And so it's a very slow onboarding when it comes to new clients. And you also have to be very careful to make sure that there's really good chemistry, because I get really deep into the business. And so if I don't have that chemistry with that client, or there has to be I would say there's good fit. In my case, it has to be a perfect fit.
Yeah, and you don't mince words. Somebody has to be able to, like, trust
so
you enough.
I've built my process as such where I have this kind of 90-day onboarding process to put them eventually into a monthly. And the 90-day onboarding is based on, by month two, if I don't see things that I can help that business, I step away.
And so I assume, I mean, this keeps your shop probably a little bit smaller than it would be otherwise, because...
Right. So that's been the issue. And that's a little bit what I talked about in my talk, is the issue has been, how do you scale that? Because what I'm realizing is that and it's the frustration I think that a lot of probably solopreneurs in small shops find, is how do you scale it when you have somebody, like in my case, I can see things in business. So how do I replicate myself? Because really the magic sauce in what I do is me looking at the business. And so I'm experimenting with different ways to scale that right now, where what I'm learning is I don't need to do all the work that comes out of those meetings. I don't need to do all the admin that comes out of those meetings. I don't need to go and sell to find new clients. I really just need to be in that spot where I can look at a business, make the recommendations, and then other people can do all the work. And so I'm figuring out ways to scale, but even that is never going to be a big company, because it's just not scalable unless I found another person like me that can see those things in business. Not that they don't exist, but that's a hard person to find, because really it's my understanding of looking at business and my years of experience that I can find those things. But I'm okay with that. I'm okay with being small. What it means is that I market myself further up the food chain, where I'm finding clients that'll pay more for what I do. And so it might always be a small group of, you know, 6 or 8 clients that I'm really deep with. I'm spending 2 or 3 years with and really changing the...
Yeah, I was going to assume that if it's a 90-day to ramp up with a client, they can't just get rid of what you're doing in a week. They can't.
No. I mean, I'm writing usually a 12-month to 24-month marketing plan. And then at that point, by month, so I'll run through the process. Month one is get to know the business. So I have a whole kind of process of how I learn about the business and look at where they are in the market and who they are. And then month two is low-hanging fruit, because I look for things that I can provide value right away. Because once I do that, my pricing is not an issue. If I can actually bring revenue to the business as opposed to being seen as an expense, I'm seen as a revenue generating.
And that's really your litmus test, is making money.
And that's also my secret sauce. I mean, that's what I can look at a business and see things that a lot of people don't, at least designers can't, you know. And then month three is plan for the future. And after month three, at that point, really we're just driving that marketing calendar. I meet with them every month and we're looking at what's coming up. And the owners love it, because they've kind of looked at what a year looks like and they have some things on the schedule and we're ahead of everything. So if we're talking about things that are happening 3 months from now, as opposed to reacting to what's in front of us.
And that sounds like a good plan. You want your clients to actually, I mean, hitting the low hanging fruit early makes a lot of sense.
Right.
giving clients work that, you know, you're still going to be working with me in 3 months, 6 months, 9 months.
Right. And what's funny is I stumbled into this business and process because I was already doing it. So I was offering my advice and my marketing knowledge and what I know about business. And it's a collective knowledge that I've collected from watching other businesses. So I might learn something with working with one client that can be applied to a different client. And they even know that. So I'll have conversations. They know that I have this client and that client. I'll say, well, my other client does this, and they already know who that other client is because they're in different industries. And it's kind of that applied knowledge. But I was doing kind of just giving that as the value add to sell the design work. But the design work has become, it becomes cheaper and cheaper because people are doing things, you know. And so what was happening is I wasn't able to go in and sell my design work at the premium price that I was charging existing clients. Existing clients got it. They looked at it and said, wow, this makes sense. We're absolutely going to pay him this because we know when he's involved, things happen. But if I go into a new situation and I say, this is what I charge for an identity package, they look at it and go, well, your work's good, but so is this guy over here, and he's half your price. What they don't see is that identity involves looking at who they are as a company and how they're positioned and, I mean, really deep things to the point where a lot of times when I do a rebrand, I give them one option because by the time I get into the rebrand, I understand the company on a level where I come in with one option and say, well, this is the best that I came up with, and here's why, and they're usually fine with it. But that's an understanding of business. It's
unbelievable.
That,
score.
This is
phenomenal. So I was giving away all this consulting, essentially, as like a way to... So I'd come in every month and meet with them.
You flipped the paradigm.
I totally flipped it. And I said, okay, if I come in, things like, oh, we need a new website. Well, you know what? Before we do a new website, why don't we do some campaigns with a couple landing pages and actually figure out like how to generate some revenue right away? At that point, if I come in and I create a landing page and a campaign that generates revenue, I can charge a much higher premium for the website because they're not going to negotiate with me because I've already paid my, you know. I mean, I have a client where he had one client that came in probably about 60 days into our relationship that paid for my entire budget for the year.
That's always good. I mean, it's always good. Right?
Whatever that's happened to me, it's just always, worked out well. I really enjoy that.
It's also nice that they shared it with you because that's the other thing is a lot of times designers don't always hear. But right. If you deal with more strategy, do you get more information than if you just deal with design?
Absolutely.
Things like that.
Absolutely.
You're an internal kind of partner.
Yeah. I mean, I'm essentially a business partner without equity, which is frustrating sometimes, but that's a totally
different... Well, that's just to write a new proposal.
That's just a different...
I think the cool part about what you're talking about, and I think a lot of designers and creatives can relate to this, is that, you know, do a little bit of investigative reporting because you talk about in another talk that you do this sort of almost haphazardry where you discover things along the way that you do. Look at what value you add to your clients that's outside of the physical design work and the sort of prowess of, I let my portfolio speak for myself. Like, what happens behind the scenes? How could you bring that stuff into the fore and not only have it be part of your marketing, but actually charge for it and put it into context? Because I think all designers, all creatives have some value that they add that isn't the thing itself.
Well, I think the thing is like some people aren't going to be good at strategy at all.
Right.
But in your case, if you find out that's what you're good at, so right. I think that's the
strengths
real thing
are really
I'm
important.
Here.
And that's,
yeah.
that's
strength
part
finders.
Of Strength Finder. I'm a big fan of the Strength Finder book and taking that test. And that really flipped it for me because when I took that test, none of my five strengths were creative. Mm. And I'm thinking, oh, this is bullshit.
Shit.
I'm taking it again. So I took it again and it was the same five strengths. I'm like, this is impossible. But then when I dove deeper into it and I looked at relationships and context with my strengths. So I saw, okay, that's why that relationship burns me out because I'm not leveraging who I really am. And this relationship I'm excited about and actually I'm really creative with that client because I'm leveraging into my strengths. The other thing I would, to play off your
super
point.
Super conditions.
I was going to say you're super conditioned.
The other thing that
I call them superpowers.
Superpowers, okay. That's a good hybrid.
A lot of people use superpowers actually. Maybe I should change it.
To kind of spur off Diana's point though, I think that designers limit themselves on what they think their abilities are because they're, what's important about a designer is not the deliverable of whatever you're doing. The creative process and the brain that you have can have ideas about other things. So you think that you're limited by, you know, my creativity is only limited to what I can design on a screen. But really, you have a brain that actually looks at things differently. And so you see things a lot of times. I think creatives see more in business, and they see creative ways out of things more than they realize, but they don't do anything with it. They don't charge for it. They don't see that as a value. And really, a good creative is not just delivering some sort of tactic, but they're actually able to use that creative power that they have and look and see ways out of things that clients don't see. And I think that they need to kind of embrace it. And that's really, to me, taking it to the next level, because now you're out of that market where you're just delivering the same tactic that somebody else is. Because once you're in that, you're in a commodity market.
And you're competing.
And you're competing with price. And if you're just competing on price, I mean, you're never going to win on just price.
Because somebody will always underbid you.
Always.
That. Yeah. Circle logo.
And I realize, like, your plan is not going to work for most designers. But finding the strength that you have over another designer will always work for you.
Right. And being able to step outside of what you think you can deliver a little bit, because I think that designers have a creative way of viewing the world, and it's not just to create logos or design something, but it's to see things of how they should work.
And your own flavor. It has to have your own vocabulary on it, because otherwise, if you're just scoping around going, oh yeah, this other person says this, I can do that too. I'll put that on my list of my qualities, or insert that word into my bio.
The other thing I would say is, you know, I didn't even go to college. I mean, I basically took my GED in high school and I started a company. And all of my kind of marketing prowess has been because I read a lot.
Well, back then when it's black and white TV, that was common.
You just drop out.
You know what? For the record, everybody state their age. Okay, I'm 35. How old are you?
43.
Okay.
37.
Yeah. Thank you, Donovan.
25.
Yeah, you're still young.
Doesn't mean we can't give you shit.
Yeah, that's fine. The reading part, though, I mean, I have a friend that went to Pepperdine, and I ask him all the time, like, what marketing books he's reading. And he's like, well, I haven't really read anything. And I just look at him like, you're insane. Like, I didn't go to college, and I'm passing you. Mm. And it's not something I love. Reading for me is very much a discipline. But for me, it's a continued education that benefits the clients.
But you also have a super condition of winning.
Yeah, well.
Yeah. So you're basically like Matt Damon in Good Will Hunting. Is like reading the books, not going to...
My
the...
wife has a thing for Matt Damon, so maybe so that is true.
There you go. Matt Damon's one of her super conditions.
Now, does she get a pass? Is that like a celebrity pass? Like, if she gets a chance, can she take it?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I think Matt Damon's just open for everybody's pass.
Because he's so slutty.
I don't know. I mean,
wait, he's actually one of our biggest listeners. We're gonna have to.
Yeah, yeah.
He's married. I've never heard anything bad about him.
We love you, man,
and all that. I just meant that, you know. I think it's just like universally accepted that you're like, okay, you got a pass. It was Matt Damon.
Yeah.
Right. I do want to ask real quick before we take a break.
He is Bourne.
Doesn't
he's
do anything
Jason
for
Bourne.
Me.
He could like.
Right.
I like the newborn guy.
Besides, if you fought it, you know, with Jason Bourne, he'd kill you. So it'd be like, I'll just give you a pass because I don't want to die.
Luke, I did want to ask you about your. On your bio, it says that you grew up in a family that there was a lot of print design mm-hmm. stuff going mm-hmm. on. Can you? What exactly was that?
So my dad had a print design company. So I grew up in print, and my dad was a designer. His specific niche was doing hospitality stuff. So he did menu and or design for hospitality, but like Hilton, Hyatt, like major hospitality chains around the country. And that was his niche. We did the design and the print. So I grew up in that business and worked for him, you know, summers and full time. At a very young age. I mean, I remember 14, 15 years old helping him run a business mm-hmm. and making decisions. So I grew up in this very hyper kind of business environment at a very, very young age. And so at 18, I talked a little bit about this in my talk. At 18, we kind of decided to sell the company. And he and I were going to go work for the company we sold it. He was going to continue to sell. I was going to be his kind of internal sales rep or internal kind of because I knew the clients. And we both lasted, I think he lasted longer than I did. I lasted 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
That was the only job I've ever had. I came back from lunch one day and I said, yeah, I'm not coming back. And she asked what she should do with my last paycheck. I told her she could keep it. So I was like, I'm done. I'm not coming back.
Wow.
So I was already moonlighting a little bit as a designer. And so my dad asked me what we wanted to do. And so together we started CrossGrain when I was 18. And with the idea that he knew he was going to kind of move on to other things at some point. And I would say probably around 21, maybe 22 was when I went really truly solo on my own. My dad's always been involved in what I do and a very, very strong mentor. I see it as kind of the kind of old world apprentice model, you know, where if you had a mason, he would apprentice the son. Yeah. And
that's
I
the
think
way it should be. That's,
that's
so
the
cool.
way it should be. And I think it's lost. I see that. Like, I have three young designers that I mentor right now. And I think anybody who hits a certain point in their career, even young, I mean, I tell the guys that I mentor, like, in the next couple of years, you will be mentoring someone else. It might be somebody just out of college, but you will be mentoring
that's
someone else.
That's the expectation.
That's the expectation.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just
beyond expectation. That's the requirement.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I've always, because of that relationship I had with my dad, with that mentorship, I've always kind of carried that through business with the other mentors that I have. One of the hot topics or kind of questions that came up out of my talk was, I mentioned last year, I spoke longer about it last year, but this year I touched on it, was this idea of an advisor board for your business.
Yeah.
So even as a solo, having three or four people that you meet with together in a room once a quarter, and you look at your finances, you look at your marketing, you look at kind of what the hot things are. And I contend that everybody has at least two people in their life that they could meet in that context. Who's and
qualified.
It could even be, like in my case, I'm really blessed. I have an ex-CFO. I have like pretty amazing guys that are on that board.
Is your dad still?
No, he's not on the board because that's kind of weird. But we have still that father-son tension too. So
I've got to ask, does he have a lot of the same strengths as you? And was, when he was doing what he was doing, was he as intimately involved with the companies? And or is that something you kind of have developed?
The business model was just different. I mean,
just
it was different.
World.
Yeah, it's just a different world and different. He's very, very strong business-wise. He and I have actually explored the idea of doing some coaching together. Because we have
like
that.
Like coaching
together? Clients, yeah.
Tag so, teaming cool. somebody?
A little bit, yeah. So we've been talking a little bit about that. So we definitely have some of the same.
I'd be guinea pig in that lab.
Yeah,
that'd be rad.
Yeah, it would be fun. Kind of the young perspective and the older perspective
yeah.
and kind of how they go together. Yeah.
Yeah,
so.
Legacy of mentorship is what I wrote down on
yeah,
when you were
yeah.
talking about. It's like there's something that's deeper than just like, oh, I have an advisory board, and then I'm also passing that along. It's
right.
way more ingrained, I think, in what the way you
to me.
Move
I can't
the
imagine. I can't imagine like life without that. And I don't understand people that go that way. I have a client right now that he's struggling with just the growing pains of what we've been able to accomplish with his marketing. And I mean, things are kind of bursting at the seams. And we started talking about like I said to him, like, why are you not on have an advisor board? And I mean, he's a much bigger company than me. He's got no
right.
real advisors, no
right.
real mentors. And I'm thinking, dude, that all this stuff can be figured out if you just get into those groups. People don't want to do it though because you have to be extremely vulnerable.
See,
I mean, imagine going to, you know, you decide to put this board together and you pick maybe one of your best friends that you know was really good at managing their finances. You have
mm-hmm.
to basically open your finances to them.
Yeah.
And people aren't willing to do that. But
probably.
To me,
so
I look at it.
He's willing to crash and burn before
right.
he's willing to
And that's
to
where I just look
himself.
At it and I'm just like, that's just stubborn and stupid. It just doesn't make sense to me. And people aren't. Now, I'm on the flip side where I share too much.
Oversharing.
Oh, okay. And so I'm really comfortable with it.
I was
going to
say
share,
something about that.
Yeah, well, yeah, you know.
Well, we're going to find out next because we're gonna take a final break here. And when we come back, we're going to have you guys ask questions to our next guest. And we got a couple questions here that, well, you already got the text from Ricardo.
Yes.
So you know
yes.
they're coming.
So I'm real excited about that.
Ready.
All right, so we've got a couple questions from Ricardo.
Yay.
Oh, my gosh.
Ricardo Crespo, for those of you listening.
Breathing.
And he says, Luke Micey, what do you see?
What the hell kind of question is that?
I like that. That's not a fuck question. That's cool. What do you see?
Oh, that's just one of them. He had a bunch for him. So.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. What do I see?
That's
like, in what up. Context? Any context?
We didn't answer the question.
He said, what do you see? And then he said, what do you see coming? So it was kind of open-ended, a little bit.
Okay.
Kind of poetic.
You know, I'll touch on, because I didn't figure out how to... I didn't figure out how to roll this into my talk, but I read probably one of the best books that I've read in 2 years on the plane from Orange County when I came to Boston, and it's called The Coming Jobs War, and it's written by the chairman of Gallup.
Mm-hmm. Gallup's headquartered in Omaha, Nebraska.
Yeah. So they, super smart guy. I mean,
what's the name of it again?
The Coming Jobs War. And he... he goes on to describe basically kind of where we're at in this country as far as jobs and our GDP versus China versus other countries, and in some ways kind of describes this pretty horrific mess that we're in that a lot of people don't see coming. I think that I honestly think that that guy is qualified for president probably more than anybody else because he figured it out. He figured out this idea of, you know, what everybody wants in the world is a good job. And the thing that's interesting about Gallup and the guys that speak and write for Gallup and with Gallup is you can't really argue against them very much because of the amount of research that they have. It's like, okay, it's backed
just
by
the data,
75 data. Years of
They're
study.
They're freaking Gallup.
They're Gallup, right? Yeah, it's right. Like, wow, credibility? I can't
they
think.
They create statistics.
Right, they create statistics. And so they have done some unbelievable research that he goes into in the book. And
Did the book have a plus or minus 4% accuracy on it?
I don't know if it did or not. I didn't see it. It may be in the back of the book.
Okay.
So what I see is amazing opportunity for us as a country and also us as entrepreneurs, but I also see a lot of fear. And I think people are going to kind of slowly lose what is this country has become known for because of this fear of the future and not really willing to say, okay, yeah, we're in trouble. We need to do something. Now, what's interesting, and my favorite chapter of the book, is that we've been here before. There was about 30 years ago when Japan and Germany were kind of like, these guys are going to be the next, you know, world leaders, essentially, as nations. And what the statistics and what the economists can't account for is entrepreneurship. Because you look what happened 30 years ago, the internet came about. And you look at what got birthed out of the internet and the computer age with Steve Jobs and Bill Gates. And, I mean, the amount of innovation and inspiration that came out of that. And I think that we, especially as creative professionals, have an opportunity to not only step up our game to create kind of jobs and businesses, but we have the ability to step up our game for our clients and help our clients realize that this is an important and he calls it a war. This is an important war for this country to win, not so much out of pride and arrogance because we're America, damn it, and we're going to do this, but because of the effects that this country has on other parts of the world. In a sense of the amount of giving that comes out of this country, the amount of good that can come out of people doing things for other countries in this world. And so it really is important that the U.S. continue to grow the GDP. And so what do I see? I see a lot of opportunity, but I also see a lot of fear.
Hmm. And Diana, he says, I hope you had fun at the Red Sox game. Why didn't I go with you? Why haven't we gotten together for lunch? And these are two questions. He meant, why'd you stand him up at the Red Sox game, he thinks? Like
Jedi.
Okay. And the lunch thing, he says he lives, like, real close to you.
So and we actually had lunch, so is he saying...
No, not at conferences.
No, not at conference. So is he saying that lunch didn't count, or that was subpar?
He probably just forgot about it.
Uh-huh.
He said that's his way of saying, I guess you stood me up, your lunch is forgettable.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't nice enough.
Really sweet of him.
Ooh, burn.
Really, really sweet. No. I love Ricardo. I'd be happy to have lunch weekly with Ricardo. But he, you know, he's a bit of a tease. He says, let's go to lunch. But that means, hey, it'd be nice to see you. I'm glad you're on the planet. It doesn't really mean that.
Wow.
Ooh. Good job. Good job asking that question, Ricardo.
That you set yourself up, Ricardo.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, speaking of which, Luke, this is also from Ricardo. When did you last...
Luke is sweating right now.
Oh, it's all right. When did you last go Brokeback Mountain camping?
Oh, God.
And...
Oh, God.
What's we'll your, go with, the, what, go with, so go with this one first.
Okay.
No, what's he referring to here?
Are you still sore?
And thank you for that, Diana.
Yoga won't help.
So there was a guy, Jovan Orozco, Jovanville Design.
Oh, we love Jovan.
Yeah, Jovan's awesome. So last year we had probably one of the best nights that I've ever had hanging out with.
Is this acceptable for...
Yeah.
My question still stands.
So, yes. So pretty amazing night in Chicago at the conference. Things that legends are made of. It was Jovan and I, this guy named Dan, I can't remember... what's his last name?
You,
yeah, I don't remember his last
can't
name.
Can remember his last name?
That was a good
Ricardo.
I was not.
And then Steve Gordon and the five of us just tore up the town in Chicago. So we were looking forward to a
reunion
of sorts this year in Boston. And Jovan couldn't make it because he said he had a camping trip. And so we thought camping with the family, that must be what he means. And he said, no, it's just camping with a bunch of the guys. And so that's where the whole Brokeback camping thing came from. So I can't remember the last time I went on a guy's camping trip. It's been a while.
All right. And this other one, I got to see if I can – there's a specific way I have to ask it, too.
So many questions.
I got to try to remember. There was a certain way you wanted this enunciated.
I think it was as Steve Gordon would say it.
What's your PIN number?
Also a story from Chicago. That one I won't share. And I'm not going to share my PIN number. Sorry. It's 0000. That's my PIN number.
All right.
I would have guessed 1234.
Yeah. And you would have been wrong. So.
Mine's 7216. I'm happy to share it. Open book.
There you go.
I originally just thought he maybe stole your wallet and he was looking for your PIN number. No. But okay.
He's crafty like that.
Yeah, he is crafty like
He's
that.
He's a minx.
Little bastard.
Luke, Diana, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show. Oh,
thank you so much.
Our next guest, Denise Korn. We need questions for her.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I want to hear from her what's the... the biggest thing that she's gotten out of mentoring other people. I think you hear a lot about what the mentee gets, and you don't hear a lot about the rewards that the mentor gets beyond just feeling good and feeling that's a purpose and whatever. But I know from my experiences of mentoring that I get a lot out of those relationships and just learning new things and seeing different perspectives. So I'd love to hear her expand on what she has gotten out of the whole mentoring relationship.
Okay, and Diana.
That's a great one. I would like to know, dear Denise, tell me a story when you were goosebumpy giddy.
Goosebumpy giddy?
Yeah.
That's a good one.
I like it. It probably involved the White Castle. From what I hear.
Maybe.
Or a pin number.
And then ask her if it's normally this hot and humid in Boston.
Yeah.
Oh.
People from California don't do hot
we,
and humid.
I'm wilting.
It's been like this in Omaha.
I've gone through so many sets of clothes. Like, I realized I didn't bring enough clothes.
Yeah.
Like, I've got.
Yeah, that's what I realized this morning, too. I thought I was going to rewear some jeans and stuff. Like, no, those
chance.
Jeans are gone. You're going to find
gone.
A laundromat.
Like, I actually might need to go find a laundromat to get.
Or just buy new clothes from the Gap.
I was already looking at that. I'm like,
I'm dumpstered him. Just took his clothes and just dumpstered him. He's like, these are shot.
You can.
The last 2 days of the next.
That is what's wrong with the world. In summary, I would love to have lunch with Ricardo anytime, any day, anywhere.
See, he didn't even ask us for lunch. I'm starting to wonder, like, if he likes to ask people
to
for lunch and then stand him up or something or just tell you. He didn't even ask us.
Are you still recording?
Well, we are now.
Then I won't add what I was going to add.